Supporters include Golden Voice, presenting Alison Krauss and Union Station, featuring Jerry Douglas, Sunday, July 13th at the Greek Theater. Tickets on sale now and available at AXS.com.
Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar.
Hi, this is Ricky Lee Jones. You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM LA, 98.7 Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Melissa Figueroa, director and producer of the show, sitting in for Susie Weissman. Susie is traveling today, but she was part of a conference in honor of Boris Kagarlitsky, who is languishing in Putin's prison for speaking out against the war in Ukraine. Today we bring you the panel from the conference discussing Boris's latest book, The Long Retreat, published while he was in prison. Three distinguished leftist activist scholars, Bill Fletcher Jr., Alex Kalinikos, and Jayati Ghosh, present their appreciation and their critiques of Kagarlitsky's analysis and account of the rise of the right and the decline of the left over the last 40-plus years. Our speakers address Kagarlitsky's clear-sighted, brutally honest, and internationalist account of the global left parties and formations today that cannot come to terms with new realities, but rather simply try to reenact the past. They also address Kagarlitsky's lucid critique of an identitarian politics of difference, which makes forming broad mass political projects very difficult. We'll get their analyses, informed by their own substantive experience and writing. We'll also ask for your support in this end-of-the-year fund drive and wish all of you a good holiday season. All this when our program returns in just a moment.
Hello, everyone. This is Susie Weissman, and I'm here to ask for your support and your sponsorship of this program, Beneath the Surface, and this station, KPFK. We're here during the fund drive, and this is the time when we ask you listeners to support the radio station. And I should say sponsor it, because it's a listener-sponsored radio station. And if you value the kind of programming that I've been bringing to you for more than 40 years, I'm going to ask you to please put your money where your ears are and go to your phones and call up at 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK or go online to www.kpfk.org and pledge your support. It costs money to keep free speech radio on the air. We don't have commercials. It's not a commercial station. And we don't sell your data anywhere, but we do ask you way too much, in fact, to cough up support for the radio station. And I'm asking you to do that now. I try consistently to bring you the best voices on the hottest topics. And I specialize in covering Russia, the former Soviet Union, experiments in social change, labor, and the economy. And I put a lot of time and effort into the shows, and we don't come to you that often to ask for you to support that effort. We're all volunteers. None of us are paid. And I've had a pretty bad year in terms of health, so I haven't been here as many times as I would have liked to. But all is looking up now, and I'm asking you for your support at 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. KPFK. Please dig deep into your pockets and give all you can. Thank you so much. I appreciate your listenership and thank you for supporting this program and this radio.
And now we present the panel on Boris Kagarlitsky's The Long Retreat with Bill Fletcher Jr., Alex Kalinikos, and Jayati Ghosh.
Hello. Yeah, I'm David Castle. I'm editorial director at Pluto Press, who published Boris's most recent book, many books by Boris, in fact, The Long Retreat. Strategies to reverse the decline of the left. It is time now to move on to our first speaker, Bill Fletcher. is a long-standing activist in workplace and community struggles. He is the former president of Trans Africa Forum and a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. He is the author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, amongst other books. Bill, over to you.
I want to thank you for the honor of participating in addressing today's conference celebrating the work of Comrade Boris Kargolitsky and acting in solidarity with a comrade in his fight for freedom. A fight, I should say, not only for his own freedom, but a fight for freedom against the forces of authoritarianism and 21st century fascism. Let me start by saying that this work is brilliant, sobering, and in some important respects, problematic. It is written out of a different political tradition than I share, i.e. he is operating in a neo-Trotskyist framework, and mine from a different orientation. Yet the different traditions did not fundamentally affect my view of the book. Though tempted to start by addressing Kargolitsky's analysis of the Soviet experiment and the Comintern, I shall instead address politics and the socialist project, imperialism, race racism, and revanchism. Central to the task of 21st century socialists and a theme running throughout the book is found on page 163, when Kargolitsky states in part, quote, "The need is for the reconstruction of the working class as a class for itself through practical activity and political struggle for its most general interests. Much of the socialist and non-socialist left has a political and the ideological struggle, in part as postmodernism crept into the body of the socialist left. A fixation developed on the personal, on abstraction as ideology, away from seeking truth from facts, and away from the battle for power, more in a direction toward a dimensional plane referenced as winning without taking power. The battle for power, both for what can be referenced as governing power within the context of democratic capitalism and state power in the context of the socialist transition to a classless society, must be rooted in social bases. Further, as Kargolitsky notes, the task of politics is to form the historic bloc. What is sobering in this book is a recognition not only of the need to unite various subaltern classes against capital, but Kargolitsky's blunt recognition of the fissures that exist and have always existed within the working class. Far too many leftists are trapped in the idealist notion of a united working class. Kargolitsky raises the point that would have once been heretical, calling into question whether one specific socialist party can actually be the party of the class. The central question emerging from this portion of his analysis is, to borrow from a tradition other than Trotskyism, from the masses to the masses. In other words, our politics must address, through the prism of a Marxist analysis, the needs, concerns, and realities of the subaltern classes, which come to be rearticulated in a manner that is democratic, progressive, if not revolutionary, and focused on the altering of power relationships. Our approach cannot be one of self-obsession to the point of narcissism and the abandonment of the masses as being hopelessly lost, if not reactionary. And as Kargolitsky notes, our politics cannot be premised on the expectation of perfection on the part of mass progressive social movements. Movements will, by definition, prove to be uneven and contradictory. Now let me shift gears. Historic imperialism is not a particular focus of the book. While Kargolitsky does address the contemporary economic situation with the emergence of globalization, he misses something that I believe to be critical when appreciating the crisis of the welfare state system and the inability to re-implement this in the current moment. As the late Samir Amin once noted in a moment of candor and humor, the welfare state would not have been possible in the absence of cheap oil. It is impossible to disconnect the ongoing crises within the working classes of Europe and North America from the question of imperialism. It's not only that the living standards in the so-called West are directly related to the question of colonialism and imperialism. It is also the failure of European and North American working classes and their organizations to consistently address matters of national self-determination and the international solidarity of the oppressed that have undermined the ability of these classes and their organizations to make a strategic breakthrough in the fight for power. This matter arises in my last section on revanchism. The West was able to build itself and rebuild itself after two world wars precisely due to the colonies and neo-colonies. Though the Russian Empire created a colonial relationship as it expanded east, an empire the USSR largely inherited, it did not offer Russia specifically the resources and opportunities to go in any way close to that of the West, particularly in light of the weaknesses of pre-1917 Russian capitalism. A second weakness in the book is the absence of the appreciation of so-called race and racism, both in the context of understanding capitalism, but equally in understanding the crises facing the working classes in Europe and North America. In fact, Kargolitsky comes very close to minimizing what he sees as other, quote, oppressions, unquote, as if they are simply matters of identity and a reflection of the postmodern infection of the left. Racism is deeply connected to colonialism and imperialism. It is not an identity question, but a matter of both a system of domination, racist and national oppression, as well as a system of social control over subaltern classes, particularly over the working class. Racism has created the most successful system of class collaboration within capitalism, with sexism running a close second, as can be seen in the experience of the British domination of Ireland and racialization of the indigenous population and its impact on the consciousness of the British working class. It evolved directly and indirectly through the slave trade in Africans, the invasion of the Western Hemisphere, and the colonial plague over most of the planet. Imperialism and racist oppression not only justified the savagery of colonialism, settler and non-settler, but convinced the working masses in the colonizing powers that they were, to varying degrees, partners in the colonial empire. Racism as a system of oppression and social control, with the latter fully operationalized as a means of creating an economic and non-economic differential in treatment between populations, does not appear to factor into Kargolinsky's analysis. This apparent absence is both noteworthy and curious. I believe that it leads him to misunderstand the movements against racist and national oppression, believing them to be primarily identity movements. It also leads him to derive incorrect conclusions about the nature of some of the anti-system protests we have witnessed over the last several years, most especially those in connection with the COVID pandemic. Before exploring the implications of these two absences, let me hasten to add a third: an underappreciation of the danger and reality of revanchism as at the core of the reemergence of right-wing populism and contemporary fascism. Revanchism is a political sentiment and practice that became noticeable in the aftermath of World War I and again after World War II. In the post-Cold War world of hegemonic neoliberal globalization, it has again become significant. Revanchism represents the politics of revenge, victimization, and resentment. It is the politics that argues that something was taken from the allegedly legitimate population and provided to someone else, someone supposedly less deserving. Revanchism was central to German nationalist movements after World War I, including but not limited to the Nazis. The impact of neoliberal globalization on working classes, particularly in the global north, is well identified by Kargolitsky. Job loss, downward living standards, the reorganization and relocation of work, and demographic changes in the working class have all contributed to immense confusion and precarity. Yet it is the choice and direction for responses which need to be noted. Let me give an example. When studying Donald Trump, or the Make America Great Again phenomenon, and the working class, there's been attention to white workers and white working people generally who've been drawn towards or galloped towards his ranks. Many sincere people have tried to explain this through addressing the impact of globalization on them. This is further explained as a feeling of betrayal allegedly carried out by the Democratic Party. There are a couple of problems with this analysis, however, before one goes too far down that road. First, and with respect to whites leaving the Democratic Party, this phenomenon was identified as beginning almost immediately after the passages of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. none other than the non-Marxist president of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, noted that the passage of the 64th Civil Rights Act probably would result in the loss of the South by the Democratic Party for at least a generation. As we can see, it turned out he was optimistic. Second, if the impact of neoliberal globalization explains the attraction of white workers to Trump, why is the millions of African Americans, Latinos and Latinas, Asians and Native Americans are not flocking to Trump? After all, neoliberalism has disproportionately hurt our populations far greater than whites. It's not just racism in the abstract, but revanchism that we see playing out. In the United States and in much of the global North, there is immense resentment among so-called whites that there is no cushion beneath them from the ravages of capitalism. A side note, revanchism in Russia has different roots, but nevertheless needs greater attention since we see it playing out in the Russian aggression against Ukraine. This is not as simple a question as white workers or some others gravitating to the right because of the failure of the left to address their concerns. At a minimum, one can see countless examples of the broad left and progressive movements waging valiant defensive battles against this or that ravage by capitalism. In the U.S., we have the example of Senator Bernie Sanders speaking loudly and forcefully, not to mention eloquently, about the impact of capitalism on working people. Why is it that we do not have a movement of equal size to MAGA around Sanders? Imperialism not only had an impact on the economies, but an impact on the consciousness of entire populations, including but not limited to the working class. None of this is to argue that the working classes in the global North cease to be oppressed, let alone exploited. And none of this is to disregard the struggles of the working classes for justice. But it is to say, literally and figuratively, there was a wage differential between the white worker and the colonized and racially oppressed worker. In the U.S. context, W.E.B. Du Bois references as a psychological wage of whiteness. Lenin addressed this in part, following from Marx and Engels, in appreciating the rise and importance of the labor aristocracy, though the labor aristocracy was not solely a racial phenomenon. The linkage of imperialism, racism, and revanchism is demonstrable. Revanchism helps us to understand better the rise of irrationalism and right-wing authoritarian movements, including movements where Kargolinsky appears to offer critical support. I want to focus for a moment on the response to the COVID pandemic. I'm in total agreement with Kargolinsky that the COVID crisis illustrated the literal and figurative bankruptcy of the healthcare systems in the capitalist world. It was not only the lack of preparedness, which to some extent could be excused in light of the fact of this being a virus, but it was the nature of the responses, including levels of repression that we used hypocritically against various movements. Kargolinsky, however, seems to diminish the extent of the plague. In the United States, the Center for Disease Control estimates that approximately 1,197,470 deaths and confirmed cases of the COVID, over 103 million. Worldwide, as of April 2024, over 7 million have died. I lost 6 friends and had COVID at least once. I never lost a friend or a loved one to the flu. Governments were faced with a crisis, but much of the response or opposition generated by the right was one of irrationalism. Open denial, refusal to take precautions, demonstrations against vaccinations, conspiracy theories, la-da-da-da-da. Interestingly, the protests were not mainly coming from communities of color, certainly in the United States. Kargolinsky's focus on a trucker caravan in Canada, in this respect, is quite interesting. It felt like an effort to create lemonade out of lemons. Yes, people were angry about restrictions imposed as a result of the pandemic. I got that. But what was being proposed in opposition? What was being proposed in response to the very real problem of dealing with a virus? An almost humorous response from the U.S. right came from the Lieutenant Governor of Texas, who argued that we should be willing to sacrifice our lives in defense of the economy. turn away from masks and vaccines, contract COVID in the name of almighty capitalism. I was looking forward to the lieutenant governor being the first sacrificial lamb. I mean, you just can't make this up. The response to COVID that was led by right-wing authoritarian forces was coded right-wing libertarianism, rhetorizing about freedom. It was a strange combination of self-suicide and genocide. In other words, there was nothing here with which to offer critical support. And this movement has now expanded to address an alleged right to refuse other vaccinations in the name of self-control over one's body, a hideous use of the call of the pro-choice movement. Revanchism makes use of a distorted view of history, particularly colonialism and imperialism. In the case of Western Europe, for instance, the antipathy towards immigrants and the articulation of neo-racist notions of racial and religious incompatibility is used to justify walls, fences, and detention centers, allegedly to protect the legitimate population. And this takes place while there remains open denial about the impact of colonialism carried out by many of these same countries. The impact of neoliberal economic reorganization, which has indeed been devastating for working classes of such countries, is, however, not recognized as being the result of a capitalist project, but is linked to Jewish machinations by the anti-Semites of the right and or linked to demographic changes in the population. Blame is sought where there is no blame to be found. Revanchism is also introduced into myth. Take, for instance, the myth of the people standing in the long line, a myth repeated here in the United States time and again. The myth goes like this. Let's suppose you're on a long line waiting for something, and you have been told that you have to wait your turn. Suddenly, some people cut in front of you. The idea behind this story is that we're supposed to understand this is how marginalized white people feel about minorities of different stripes allegedly jumping ahead of them, while they, white people, are playing by the rules. Problem is that the myth has no relationship with history or reality. There never was one line. And to the extent that lines existed, it was more like what they would call in the longshore industry, the shape-up. That is a system where people show up for work and the foreman get to pick who works. It was precisely the system that Harry Bridges of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union led the revolt against and replaced with a democratic system for job allocation. It was also the case, certainly in the US, where people of color were driven off the line and there was a mass pretending that we had never been there in the first place. But the myth is strong and reinforces the idea that something has been taken away from hardworking, good white people. This is not about identity politics. This is about a system that has ensured the relative stability and the hegemony of capitalism for hundreds of years. And no discussion of revanchism is complete without a recognition of the centrality of the counter-revolution against women contained in revanchism and contemporary right-wing authoritarianism. There has been a full-blown assault on every victory won by women since the 19th century. This is an assault that seeks to structurally suppress women, reinforce male supremacy, and reaffirm traditional gender roles. This is not primarily a matter of identity or gender identity. This element of revanchism appeals to often educated yet marginalized men, men whose economic prospects are dimmed in both the global North and global South, men who are threatened by the implications of the emancipation of women and seeing that a threat to those spheres of life that are actively protected as male-only or male-preferred arenas. This element of revanchism is filled with misogyny and as such filled with violence. Taking on the far right and in fact uniting the working class in a battle for power necessitates a recognition that this is no sideshow from the class struggle. It is not that the struggle against the racist and male supremacist sides of revanchism are important. It should be the recognition that there can be no unity unless socialist politics are truly emancipatory politics. The sort of framework I'm suggesting here does not appear to be in The Long Retreat, though periodically there are hints and elements of such an analysis. The failure to incorporate these matters of imperialism, racism, sexism, and revanchism into one's analysis, or to treat some of this at least as tangential, means that strategy will be flawed. strategy for socialist renewal in the global north, including the former Soviet bloc, will necessitate significant attention to systems of oppression that parallel and overlap with the exploitation and oppression of workers. This will mean that demands and struggles will have to expand the understanding of the, quote, general interests, unquote, of the working class. If we are to recognize, as Kargolitsky does, the fragmentation with the working class, then socialist politics will need to center the process and struggles to unite the class, not on the basis of silence in the face of racial, national, sexual oppression, but in ensuring that the working class unites in the context of the battle for consistent democracy. My optimism about Kargolitsky's The Long Retreat, perhaps paradoxically, comes from Kargolitsky's commitment to socialist politics, that is, the practice of building a movement for an alternative. A true commitment to critically analyze the challenges facing the oppressed and visualize them in the process of building a new historic bloc necessitates that one comes to grips with the historic and contemporary challenges presented by imperialism, racism, male supremacy, and other forms of oppression that have either generated by capitalism or captured and rearticulated by capitalism in ways that help to advance the system. A final point. I have focused so much on revanchism since it is so very central to right-wing authoritarian movements across the world. It succeeds to the extent to which populations can be successfully divided and one declared to be legitimate and another illegitimate. To the extent to which our 21st century socialist politics ignores this or treats this as just a perverse, unfortunate, though understandable response to neoliberal capitalism and its horrors, we miss one sobering point. There are and will be sections of the subaltern classes generally, and the working class in particular, across the planet will become convinced that they have a place within the framework and organization of right-wing authoritarianism. These are forces who we should understand are lost to us and should not be the center of our attention. When the robber baron of the 19th century, Jay Gould, once said that he could buy one half of the working class to kill off the other, we should understand he was only being partially euphemistic. Let me end by thanking the conference organizers and especially thanking Boris Kargolitsky. Thanking Boris for his courage, not only in struggling against authoritarianism and for socialism, but courage in putting forth his views and engaging in a global dialogue. I submit this to you, to borrow from Twilight Zone founder Rod Serling, for your consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bill, for that very thought-provoking presentation. Lots to chew on there. I'd like to move on straight away to our second speaker. Alex Kalinikos has been a major figure on the British Marxist left for decades. He is now Emeritus Professor of European Studies at King's College London. He is a columnist for the Socialist Worker newspaper and was editor of the journal International Socialism from 2009 until 2020. He's the author of many books. Three of the most recent are The New Age of Catastrophe, Deciphering Capital, and The Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx. Over to you, Alex.
Thanks very much, and thanks to everyone involved in the campaign. Now, I've known Boris Kargolitsky since March 1990. Over the years, I'd met him again and again in different parts of the world, very often because we were both involved in what was so misleadingly called the anti-globalization movement. So I admire Boris tremendously for his lucidity, his courage, his determination, and also his wit. I also admire him intellectually. But we have disagreed over the years, as well as massively agreeing on most things. And in the same spirit as Bill pursued certain disagreements, I want to talk a bit about disagreements. But the disagreements spring from comradeship and solidarity and mutual respect. However, first to say something about a particular quality of Boris's writings, which is his internationalism. Of course, he's someone who's deeply rooted in Russian realities, and this is reflected in his very courageous refusal to go into exile or take part in a prisoner exchange. But nevertheless, he views these realities from a global perspective, more specifically from the more Marxist version of world systems theory. And this internationalism is very visible in The Long Retreat, partly in the range of reference that he has. So he doesn't just talk about Marx, he talks about Weber, about Schumpeter. He draws on a range of intellectual sources, but also in how he seeks to address the common situation of the left, not just the situation of the left in Russia. I mean, that's very clear in the contributions we've already heard. But the internationalism is analytical. In the book, he confronts the state of the left, the global left, in what I call, in my most recent book, The New Age of Catastrophe, economic stagnation, the COVID-19 pandemic, climate catastrophe, and the terrible wars raging in Ukraine and Gaza. Now, I agree with much of Boris's diagnosis, but it's boring just to agree. And so I want to talk about the disagreements. I've got two particular differences. Now, the second very much overlaps with a lot of the things that Bill said. So the first disagreement is what I call a tension in his historical analysis. In part one of The Long Retreat, he has a very good analysis of the context in which the Russian Revolution of 1917 took place, more particularly the First World War. So he presents a picture which in a certain way is fairly orthodoxly Leninist of a world that is being wrecked by inter-imperialist rivalries, by the struggle for global domination of the great imperialist powers. Now, I think this analysis is fully applicable to the present world. But Boris, in The Long Retreat, doesn't take this step. He instead focuses on the domestic Russian causes of the invasion, the contradictions of the Putin regime that leads it to take this savage act of attacking and seeking to conquer Ukraine. And of course, that's an important part of the story. And what he says is very useful. But I couldn't understand why he stopped there and didn't talk about the global context. And it's only in reading one of the texts that Boris has produced from prison, and it's amazing how fertile and productive he manages to be in very difficult conditions, that I understood the answer. I mean, if we talk about an inter-imperialist conflict, then that means there are imperialisms on both sides. Now, no one doubts that the United States is an imperialist power. Russia is still a weak imperialist power. It's returned with the collapse of the Soviet Union to its past status, as Boris puts it, as an empire of the periphery, seeking to maneuver in an environment that it very much doesn't control, doesn't dominate. Weakness, of course, is consistent with and may indeed encourage brutality, as we've seen in how Russia has conducted the whole war in Ukraine. But one key effect of the present war and reflecting Russia's weakness has been to push it closer to China. One of the things that the Western media scratch their heads about is that the Russian economy didn't collapse because of Western sanctions, that on the contrary, the Russian economy is growing quite fast, is experiencing a consumer boom, and so on and so forth. Now, that's partly because, as the Western commentators like the Financial Times grudgingly admit, because Putin has a very clever economic team, a group of economic technocrats who've essentially adopted a policy of military Keynesianism. But there's a key external factor, which is the support that China has given Russia, partly in buying Russian oil and gas, but also in supplying Russia with the high-tech goods that it needs in order to continue the war. But Boris denies in this text that I'm referring that China is itself an imperialist power. He argues that the Chinese elite is fairly indifferent to the world outside it. It's not trying to shape the world. It simply opportunistically takes resources and markets from the rest of the world. Now, this seems to me completely wrong. Russia is the biggest manufacturing and trading economy in history. This is crucial. And it's also, it's exporting germs. An economy like that, as Britain and Germany were in the past, and also in its own more complicated way, the United States was, cannot be indifferent to its external environment. It has to shape it. And we see that China seeks to shape it itself, partly through a mixture of diplomacy and ideological self-projection, as presenting itself as the guarantor of a genuinely pluralistic globalization, as opposed to the kind of globalization that the US has promoted. But beyond this diplomacy and cultural policy, China is in conflict with the United States. This is true, crucially, in geoeconomic terms. I don't have time to elaborate, but China and the United States are competing over whose economy is going to dominate the green transition. Look at the panic in the US and the EU over Chinese firms' increasing success in producing cheap and high-quality electric vehicles. But there's also a geopolitical conflict. The Chinese elite have made it perfectly clear that they want to push the United States to end the US's dominance of the Asia-Pacific region, the dominance that it's enjoyed since the end of the Second World War. Taiwan is part of this story, but it's just part of a larger story. And because Asia is the dynamo of the world economy, this is a life or death issue for the United States. Now, when you begin to unravel the nature of the competition between the US and China, this is an inter-imperialist conflict. And it's this conflict that provides the context to the Ukraine war, that makes Russia's continued participation sustainable, and that gives the US the incentive to keep the war going. This is the context to the plight of Boris and the other Russian anti-war prisoners that we're in solidarity with. So I think they're serious weaknesses in Boris's understanding of imperialism. Now, since I've got a little time, I want to say that I share Bill's reservations about Boris's anti-wokeism. I mean, for example, I agree completely with what Bill says about Boris's mistakenly generous interpretation of the so-called Freedom Convoy, or whatever it called itself, in Canada a couple of years ago. I think that Boris historically has had a tendency to be relatively understanding of movements, even if they have a reactionary political content, that are motivated by what he sees as legitimate economic grievances. I think Bill's right that in this case, he's wrong about the grievances having a legitimacy, but I think that this is a broader tendency that helps to explain the mistaken view that Boris took of the separatist movements in the southeast Ukraine around 2013, 2014. And I think Bill is absolutely right that race, and one could say also migration, which are central issues to the advance of the far right that is taking place in such a frightening scale in Europe, isn't treated sufficiently seriously and sufficiently materialistically by Boris. I would say also, very briefly, that I think that if we look at so-called anti-woke ideology, one key element is that the far right, with the support of the Catholic Church and so on, make against what they call gender ideology. And here, this attack on trans rights and trans liberation, I think, is essential to the kind of hegemonic project that the far right is trying to pursue. It plays on all sorts of male anxieties and maybe resonates with the kind of revanchism that Bill was talking about, but it also fits in with the great replacement theory. the fact that the idea that there's an elite plot to essentially shrink the white population of the world and subordinate them to peoples of other colours. So these so-called identity issues are actually very important issues, both in the construction of the far right, but also they're key issues. You know, if the left wants to speak to people in the 21st century, for example, to the young people who certainly in Britain are so inspired by the movement for trans liberation, the left needs to learn to find ways of understanding and presenting the fights over race and gender and so on as part of its own political project. This means that I very much agree with Nancy when she talks about linking together what we might call narrowly class issues and issues of identity. We have to fight on the bread and butter economic issues like wages and austerity and so on. But we also have to, and this for me is of fundamental importance, we have to reflect the reality that the kind of working classes that exist, well, throughout the world, but certainly in the old imperialist core these days in North America and in Europe, is increasingly diverse and multicultural, layered and divided in all sorts of ways because of economics and racism and so on and so forth. But it's this diverse, heteroclite working class that is the potential agent of liberation. And we need to construct a politics that is capable of encouraging more and more workers to see themselves as working class and as part of this collective project. Now, I don't think Boris would disagree with a moment about the necessity of doing that. But if you want to achieve a certain objective, you need to be clear about the means and the particular points of conflict that it involves. And this means developing a politics that is sensitive to the issues of oppression and the struggles for liberation that they give rise to. I'll leave it there. I mean, I think it's clear that there are disagreements with Boris among the participants to this conference, but I think it's a tribute to the power of his thought that he should have stimulated us to think about these issues. Thanks very much.
Many thanks, Alex, for that very insightful presentation. So I can now move on to our final speaker. Jayati Ghosh is Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She has consulted with numerous international organizations. She's been appointed to the UN Secretary General's High-Level Advisory Board on Effective Multilateralism, and she is on the World Health Organization's Council on the Economics of Health for All, amongst many other roles. Her latest book is The Making of a Catastrophe, the Disastrous Economic Fallout of the COVID-19 Pandemic in India.
Thanks very much, David. And it is really a huge honor and privilege, not just to be part of this panel, but to be able to speak at a conference discussing the work of Boris Kagalitsky. I think, like everyone else here, I'm full of admiration and respect for his commitment, his fearlessness, his intellectual integrity. But I also have to point out, I did feel the immense profundity of his book. I think, like all the other speakers, I also have disagreements with many of the specific arguments and the details. But I felt that this was a very insightful assessment of the Soviet experience, but also of the problems that we face globally in even garnering the kinds of support for socialism that many of us thought we could take for granted in an earlier period. And I think he's been particularly interesting about capturing the difficulties of getting our vision, not just across, but even something that is accepted by those whom we thought were the natural home of this vision, the oppressed, the working class, the exploited, broadly speaking. And it's really that issue that I want to take up. So if you will forgive me, I'll just begin by quoting a particular paragraph from his conclusion, which I thought made some very important points. And I quote, "The politics of socialism are complex, aimed at restoring the social quality of government, a quality undermined by the logic of market competition that has acquired a more radical form under the conditions of neoliberalism. Overcoming the consequences of fragmentation, however, is no longer a question of affirming the ideological principles of the left, but is becoming one of meeting the social requirements felt in different fashion by people who hold diverse views and who even belong to different social groups and classes. The problem is one of uniting these people for shared constructive work without dividing them either on the basis of identity or of ideology or of class in the narrow sense. This is especially true since, as the process of transformation goes ahead, the class structure of society and its culture inevitably change. And attempts to preserve them in their initial forms, to fix or freeze them bureaucratically, become a factor of social conservatism, even if these efforts are accompanied by revolutionary slogans. Society cannot be integrated successfully through an enforced common ideology, but only through participation in the building of a new economy and through joint decision-making on different levels." I cannot tell you how much this resonated with me. I think this is really captures, in a sense, many of the contradictions, dilemmas, and difficulties we all face when we are trying to generate a socialist politics on the basis of our own political economy understanding. And when things that appear obvious to us are absolutely not seen as obvious or even as acceptable by a very wide range of people who should be, as I said, on our side in that sense. And I'm coming to this from very much a South Asian perspective and a developing country perspective in which, let's face it, imperialism is taken for granted. So we're not even going into the issue of whether he's got a correct understanding of imperialism or not, because in the world that I inhabit, it's taken for granted. It is a lived reality. And the ways in which imperialism works, particularly through the ruling classes, the local ruling classes, is also taken for granted. And so I think what I'm trying to think about is how that dilemma that Boris has so correctly identified, how do we deal with that dilemma? So I'm not really going to address his book. I'm going to talk about the things that he made me think about in terms of the socialist problem, if you like, in this the current situation that we face, when all the features that Bill and Alex have identified, absolutely true, and I completely take all of those points. And yet, we find such constraints in terms of getting our messages across. And I think it's really because we, many of us, I mean, don't necessarily think that way, but we're very much still identified with some older visions of the left project. And I think those visions of the left project have to be explicitly changed. And we have to explicitly make it clear to what extent we are either abandoning them or moving away from them or reforming them. And I'm going to identify seven of them, which I think are particularly important. I think first is that we have to reject democratic centralism. We really have to go for democracy, not democratic centralism. In my own country, I have seen how it works in our communist parties or even our social democratic parties. And we have to move towards a much more organic and genuinely representative democracy that gives a voice to everyone. And that's not as easily done as it is said. I know of very few places where it has really worked. And there is a tension, I also must admit, between this much more vibrant, organic, genuine democracy and the ability to get things done in what is still a very deeply imperialist world in which power structures will operate in ways that require a much more organized resistance and response. So it is a dilemma, but I want to highlight that. The second, I think, is a rejection of over-centralization. And again, it's kind of related to the first, but it's not only. We still tend to privilege the large. We tend to privilege, economists would call it economies of scale, but essentially we tend to privilege more centralized rather than decentralized options, both in economic terms and in social terms. And I think that is something that many of us kind of imbibed. As I said, in developing countries, you imbibe it because we have all been seeing centralized planning as a major means of enabling development and overcoming economic backwardness. But we have to think of newer and different ways of doing this, and in every possible aspect, not just in economic terms, but also socially and politically. The third is possibly potentially controversial, but it's about property. Yes, we reject private property, but I think we overdid it in some cases in terms of what we advocated. And I've seen this certainly in countries like Vietnam and elsewhere, that in many countries, the experiment meant a decimation also of personal and communal property in ways that were not sufficiently sensitive to specific historical, social, and other requirements. And the importance of personal and communal property and the recognition of different kinds of property, I think, is something that we have to be thinking much more carefully and in a more nuanced fashion. The fourth is the issue of rights, human rights. And, you know, it's funny because many of my comrades in the left over decades have often seen these as a reflection of, you know, a bourgeois notion of the world and the emphasis on civil and political rights and is seen as something that then subordinates the social and economic rights, which is possibly problematic. But when you think about it, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is actually a socialist agenda. It's unachievable in the world we have today. It's certainly unachievable under capitalism. But it is a socialist agenda. The recognition of rights of different kinds, I think, it's not always inimical, but I would argue that we in the left have not always sufficiently been always conscious of those. And we have not used them to the extent that we could, perhaps, even in our political lobbying and mobilization and so on. The fifth issue is something that I think already was raised by Bill and by Alex, that, you know, the issue of other identities other than class. Both of them have pointed to Boris's sort of anti-wokeness issue. But I think, you know, really there is a problem here. And certainly it relates to the next one that I'm going to identify. But, you know, the inability to build coalitions, to recognize differences and then build coalitions across them, I think is a problem. The emphasis on class as the dominant contradiction, which in many ways it is, but in some cases imperialism is more, in some cases other identities mix in so inextricably with class that you cannot just focus on one without the other. I know in India, caste plays such a role, for example. So I think this is something that maybe we in the left need to think much more about how to adequately recognize and build coalitions across other identities so that we create a much more joint popular front rather than enable the fragmentation that Boris also described. The sixth is the whole issue of, you know, what used to be called the woman question, the gender question. And I think that's critical. But I think it's also critical in economic terms because, you know, the left, just as much as the right, has been such a, shall we say, exploiter of unpaid labor. And it's, of course, gender differentiated, the unpaid labor that occurs, and we know what role it plays in capitalism. But I would argue that the left, too, has been a significant exploiter of unpaid labor, and certainly an insufficient emphasis on gender and the various roles it plays in discrimination, exclusion, differentiation in society, in economy, and in politics. And finally, of course, you know, something which is now very much on everyone's agenda, the issue of environment and nature, which we have historically disregarded and we're only beginning to come to terms with now. Planetary boundaries, natural, the exploitation of nature, the inability to be in harmony, shall we say, with ecology and the environment. I think this has been as true of leftist regimes as it has been of purely capitalist or neoliberal regimes. But it's also something that we still don't adequately, I think, factor in our mobilization, in our advocacy, and in our politics. Having said that, I also just then want to emphasize maybe a couple more things where I think there's continuity. I already talked about imperialism, and I think both Bill and Alex have emphasized the significance of it. I want to me, imperialism is essentially the struggle of large capital over economic territory, where it is assisted by nation states. And that means it's constantly taking new forms, because economic territory itself is not just redefined, it is enlarged, it is expanded. We have new forms of economic territory that we didn't even think about in the past. We used to think about land, markets, labor, but now we have cyberspace, now we have new intellectual property rights as markets and so on, which are all expressed in very dynamic imperialist ways. And that is a continuity from the past, but it's one that we need to be factoring in much more in everything that we do. And I don't think even we in the global left do that sufficiently. And finally, the nation state. I mean, I don't like it. I hate it. But it remains the terrain in which we have to play out many of these things, whether it is rights, whether it is the whole issue of the kinds of democracy or the reduction of centralization and so on, the nation state remains critical. So we have to aim for really internationalism rather than a kind of withering away right now of the state, unfortunately, I think. These are all controversial statements. I'm sure these are not necessarily agreed to by everyone here either. But I think it's a tribute to how Boris forces us to think, and how his book, which I repeat, I think I found it to be very profound in important ways. I think that it forces us to also think about our own national and international contexts and what we really have to do in order to take our project forward. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. This is Susie Wiseman, and I'm here to ask for your support and your sponsorship of this program, Beneath the Surface, and this station, KPFK. We're here during the fund drive, and this is the time when we ask you listeners to support the radio station. And I should say sponsor it, because it's a listener-sponsored radio station. And if you value the kind of programming that I've been bringing to you for more than 40 years, I'm going to ask you to please put your money where your ears are and go to your phones and call up at 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK, or go online to www.kpfk.org and pledge your support. It costs money to keep Free Speech Radio on the air. We don't have commercials. It's not a commercial station. And we don't sell your data anywhere, but we do ask you way too much, in fact, to cough up support for the radio station. And I'm asking you to do that now. I try consistently to bring you the best voices on the hottest topics. And I specialize in covering Russia, the former Soviet Union, experiments in social change, labor, and the economy. And I put a lot of time and effort into the shows, and we don't come to you that often to ask for you to support that effort. We're all volunteers. None of us are paid. And I've had a pretty bad year in terms of health, so I haven't been here as many times as I would have liked to. But all is looking up now, and I'm asking you for your support at 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. KPFK. Please dig deep into your pockets and give all you can. Thank you so much. I appreciate your listenership, and thank you for supporting this program and this radio.
That's our show for today. I'd like to thank our panelists, Bill Fletcher Jr., Alex Kalinikos, and Jayati Ghosh. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archived shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click on Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page, Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening.